Scientific Imagination is part of the Future-Based platform. My name is Sabine Winters. For more information, visit scientificimagination.org. In this podcast, I will go into conversation with Dr. Samantha Copeland about the role and function of serendipity in science and the connection between serendipity and imagination in science. Dr. Samantha Copeland is our next guest on Scientific Imagination. Samantha came to philosophy through humanities, graduating at Carleton University, Ottawa in Canada. She did a Master's of Philosophy at Queen's University, and for her PhD dissertation, The Case of the Triggered Memory, she joined her interest in how scientific knowledge is produced and changes when new technology is developed with the ethics of curiosity-driven science, and human participants are needed for research. From there, she joined the Cause Health Project for 3 years as a postdoctoral fellow at the Norwegian University of Life Science. And in the meantime, she co-founded the Serendipity Society and joined TU Delft as an assistant professor in 2018. At the TU Delft, she's working on the ethics of resilience, bringing what we know about positive results can come out of unexpected events, like cases of serendipity, together with how we ought to prepare a response to unexpected but potentially disastrous events and disruptions. In both of these contexts, issues of disruptive and epistemic justice are intertwined with the epistemology of knowledge production. It is at this intersection that her work resides. Thank you so much for joining.
Thanks for having me.
Could you please give an introduction of your background and your current occupation?
Well, you did a fairly good job there. So I did come out of philosophy in Canada, and there I was looking into scientific discoveries, basically, because I was looking at how we move from developing theory through discoveries that happen in science and then into practice. So I was looking at medical technologies, which is another thing that I work on right now. So I work with ethics and resilience, and I also work with the ethics of developing healthcare technologies, which is becoming a bigger part of my work. So I was working on the theory behind medical interventions, specifically antidepressants, and then brain surgery interventions, so deep brain stimulation. That's the triggered memory case that I looked at. So how those theories came about, and so the nature of scientific discovery and the application of theory. And the wonderful thing about these contexts is that they're also really messy, and I like messy contexts, where as we apply these interventions, we actually change the way we think about the context we're applying them in, and we develop theory through application. So because of this back and forth, it becomes the research ethics of these contexts becomes very important and gets wrapped up in theory formation and how that theory then grounds our justification for applying things. So we think that antidepressants work on our brains because they adjust our serotonin levels, for example. But in reality, we developed the theory of depression based on serotonin levels out of the way that antidepressants work. So it's even though we apply things kind of forward looking, we tend to develop them backward from what we usually think about as discoveries and theory. So that was all very interesting to me. And then also, as I'm researching, there was all this unexpected discoveries that were playing a really important part in that theory formation. So then I started thinking about the role of the unexpected in how we make discoveries and how we develop theories and how we apply them. And then who's involved became very important as well. When you're talking about things like neurosurgery and about psychopharmacology, there's politics, there's funding, there's hospitals, there's regulations, there's the FDA, there's all of these different stakeholders and people who are shaping the application. And that really complex context is something that I find is existing as well in resilience engineering. So now we're trying to deal with the uncertainty in our world and plan for it in some way. So what happens when we try to plan for the unexpected?
You were referring to messy contexts. Is politics also part of this messy context?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And in the sense that it kind of matters how discoveries get taken up into society, whose concepts are being used to understand that discovery. So, I mean, we can understand new things in a lot of different ways. But when we see them as having a potential use, that comes out of our own interests, right? And our values. And so who we are actually makes a big difference into how and whether that discovery gets taken up at all. Mm-hmm. And then by whom and how it gets used. And sometimes I look at the Fleming discovery, and I like to point out that it's not that penicillin had never been noticed or come across before, or that its effects or the possibility of antibacterial effects had never been noticed. We just hadn't put medicine and antibacterial effects together before. But just before penicillin, just around the time of Fleming's discovery, and as penicillin got taken up as a potential treatment, people were working off the success of the sulfonamides, which was another drug that suddenly dealt with diseases in a way that they hadn't imagined possible before. So this was a new possibility, and suddenly discovery that was made accidentally seemed to have a purpose, right? And so it the timing is good in multiple ways. It's not just the discovery moment. It's also whether that discovery can get taken up as something that's valuable has a lot to do with the context and who's looking at it, who's exchanging information, whose file drawer those results have been sitting in, who is teaching a class and mentioned an example. All of these things have to do with time and place, but also with people and their attitudes and their values and their perceptions and their priorities.
We are slowly already moving to this topic of serendipity. Mm-hmm. Could you tell me what the Serendipity Society is and how did it come about?
Yeah. So because I was working on accidental discoveries and how they led to deep brain stimulation as a technique, and then I ended up focusing on a case where an accidental discovery was made while operating on someone to give them deep brain stimulation. And then I looked at the ethics of following up on that, right? Can we ethically follow up on such a discovery and abandon our current research project? And many people talk about serendipity as this amazing, great thing where, you know, you just leave behind what you were doing and take on a new direction. And it's all very exciting and promising. But basically, there's a lot of stories out there of serendipitous discoveries, a lot of narratives and a lot of rhetoric, and a few studies in different disciplines. But it was hard to kind of work through the resources that were out there and to find the theory and to figure out how this field was developing. And it seemed like there was a field developing. There was serendipity research happening in a few different disciplines. There's some organizational and management theory, and there's information sciences theory, and a little bit of philosophy of science was talking about it, some psychology of creativity. But I couldn't get a handle on the field. And my dissertation supervisor told me to stop reading and write my thesis already. So I'd put off all of this serendipity literature until I had time during my postdoc to get back into it.
Wow.
So I found myself reading all of this literature, and a lot of it was written by Laura McKay Pete. And when I looked her up, I found out she had been writing a PhD on serendipity at the same time, at the same university that I had been writing my PhD on serendipity. And I happened to be heading back to Halifax the next summer to visit family. And so I called her up and we had a coffee at the Coburg Coffee House, and we had both had the same problem in our research. And so we decided, well, what young researchers really need in this field is a resources page and a place to consolidate the good research that's happening. And I made a web page and we created a resources page out of contributions from people we knew and our own bibliographies. It's just kind of been a snowball ever since. And as word has spread, I guess we've touched on a real zeitgeist, because there's just more and more people from diverse areas of practice and research that are coming forward and are interested in not only just serendipity for fun, but in finding out what it is and how we can use it and how we can make it happen and how we can not lose it as we, you know, use more algorithms and control our lives more. Mm-hmm, And so now we have well over 100 members, and it continues to grow, and they're from all over the world, and they're different levels of scholarship. We have a lot of junior scholars. We have practitioners who work in software engineering or innovation practice who try to generate serendipity in their lives and in the lives of the people they work with. So yeah, it's just ballooned into this network.
I think that's just fantastic, really inspiring. As a philosopher, though, I wonder, and I heard you say the same, what is serendipity? Mm-hmm. And what are the key traits of serendipity? Mm-hmm. Is there a definition?
There is the Walpolean definition, which is accidents and sagacity. But even Walpole himself gives about two or three different versions, and then also kind of backs away from defining it in his letter where he creates the term, right? He says, you know, it's better by example. You know, I'll tell you a story instead of giving you a definition. So even he resists defining it, right? And then there's the rhetorical aspect of serendipity talk. Much of it is more about the luck than about the wisdom, right? So you've got accidents and sagacity. You could say luck and wisdom is another way people say it. But lots of the serendipity stories are about how cool it is that this discovery was accidental, right? And they're and so over time, that kind of chance aspect of serendipity has become more emphasized in the popular way of conceiving it. It's also been very personalized over time, where people talk about the aha moment or the eureka surprise aspect of it, and also about stories that emphasize the personal significance of certain discoveries. It was, oh, it was serendipitous that I met this person, and then we fell in love, or, you know, or it was serendipitous that I went to this conference, or that I walked into this lecture because my high heel had broken. There's these kinds of stories, right, where they're very personal stories about people's pathways and how they their lives were shaped. And these are not wrong. That's the thing. These are also aspects of serendipity. And then you have the big serendipity stories, like the Fleming story, right? Where, you know, the Petri dish and the Nobel Prize and the life-changing discovery that, you know, the face of medicine. And so you have these grand scale serendipitous stories as well. And then if you want to break down some of these stories, like the Fleming story, it's almost endless how much chance is involved in these kinds of narratives. There's moment after moment of, you know, interactions and encounters and discoveries, and just happen to be in the right place with the right facilities at the right time with the right public needs. All of this is wrapped up in the narrative as a whole. So it's not just the moment with the Petri dish, but also the whole process of the discovery of penicillin could be thought of as serendipitous in many ways. So now you start to think, you know, is everything serendipity? Is there a way to like mark off what it is and what it isn't? And what's cool about the research being done now is that different people are focusing on different parts of the process of serendipity and understanding it and making it happen, right? So Wendy Ross, for example, she's working on the moment of insight, right? And so for her, she really wants to break down what is that moment that we say is the significant moment in the process of discovery, and how do we understand what's happening cognitively and interactively in those moments. Other people are looking at kind of outcome. Urbano Ravidio has written some stuff on the importance of, you can create serendipity online, for example, through an algorithm, but you might actually kind of just create the surprise and not the serendipity. So what's the difference between those two outcomes?
Wonderful.
What's more than surprise about the serendipity? And so then you want to look at, say, what's life-changing about it? What is the difference that it's making? Why do we call it serendipity and not just luck? And for me, that's the key question as a philosopher, because I'm like, well, now we've got some epistemology happening here. Right. So what is the difference between serendipity and luck? And it has to do with the wisdom aspect. And a little bit of agency is in there too, right? Luck is something that happens to us, whereas serendipity is something that we make happen out of a chance event. So the human aspect of that and the human involvement in that process is the key thing that differentiates it. So if you go back to Merton, one of the first people to theorize about serendipity and how important it was to science. And he wrote the famous book on serendipity from 2004. It's the kind of the history of the word and its role in how we understand science. And if you haven't read it, it's great. He's got the serendipity pattern, where he talks about how basically the unexpected datum, you know, imposes itself upon the researcher, who then strategically applies it in a way, right? So there's this back and forth between the unexpected imposing itself upon us, disrupting our way of understanding things. And then also we contribute something by saying what it is that we've learned from that process. And strategic, he points out, is the element where the theorist who's noticed this new thing finds a way to fit it in to the greater understanding of the world, right? To theory. Mm-hmm. So in his case, sociological theory. You want to be able to apply it somehow and say, how does it change sociological theory? That's the value of the unexpected discovery, right? So something unexpected happens, it's not necessarily valuable. It's just unexpected. If something lucky happens, you might not have had anything to do with it. But when serendipity happens, you have the value and you have the agency of the person, and you also have the chance factor. So in my dissertation, I pointed out that these three things were essential for serendipity, but how you sort out what those three things are kind of depends on which part of that process you want to focus on. So the value at the moment of discovery might not be the same thing as the long-term value of that discovery process. So if you focus on different parts of the process, you're going to get a different sense of what's essential for serendipity and to understand, you know, how to pinpoint when it's happening. So it's a slippery concept, and it's really interesting to see it developing as a field of research, because there's so many different people making it more robust in so many different ways right now that I'm excited over the next few years to see how that theory starts to come together and really solidify into a framework of understanding it as a thing that happens in our world.
Exactly. In my research, I'm just at the very start, and this podcast is part of it. I'm focused on the role of imagination in sciences and some concepts that triggered me when you were talking about serendipity, for example, the role of the actor, the value of something new, and how is this relation between imagination and serendipity? Is serendipity part of imagination, or is it the other way around?
So my personal focus has been on the role of serendipity in changing our expectations. So what makes something unexpected? And this is, I think, more important than understanding chance in some kind of ontological sense. I think we want to understand what's giving us a clue into an epistemological context that we want to highlight and say exists, right? Mm-hmm. A specific kind of context. And for me, that context is the changing of expectations. So if you think about the kind of lots of examples of serendipity, has to do with where something is found or how it was discovered, or, and a lot of times this gets left out of the narratives too, is who told them about it. Who gave them the information that then became the thing that moved them? Or what interaction did they have that changed their perspective? And it's this perspective changing, this expectation changing. This is the moment where I think imagination plays a key role, because when you go into an experiment, you already have a set of possibilities in mind, right? So you've got so this might happen, that might happen. And that's the extent of your imaginative world in that sense. But when something unexpected happens, well, then you have to reconfigure the material you use to imagine those possibilities. And you've got new ways of imagining things opening up. Oh, I never thought that would happen. Now I have to think about my apparatus in a different way, or I have to think about the world in a different way, that it can produce this kind of thing or do this kind of thing, or that this kind of thing exists in it. Or I have to think about people in a different way, where suddenly talking to those people is going to be really important to me. And I didn't think, you know, and this is where interdisciplinarity can be so fun, right? When you discover another field and you're like, oh my God, you guys are talking about the same stuff we're talking about. You're just using different words. And you change the way you thought about your own concepts by seeing this alternative perspective on the same kind of thing, right? So it doesn't have to be something totally novel. This unexpectedness changes. Now you're going forward in the world and you have different expectations about what might happen. So your imaginative possibilities have grown. And I think this is really, so one way I think this is really interesting is tied to hermeneutical injustice. Have you heard of it?
But maybe you can explain. Yes.
So in the feminist theory, and one of the better books I read in grad school was Moral Textures by Maria Pia Lara, and she talks about these imaginative possibilities that one of the reasons why oppressed groups or individuals don't get out of their world or change their world is because they actually don't have the resources to imagine a different world. They've never been told that was possible. They've never been given a hint that they could have anything different. So they don't have those resources in their imagination to think of themselves as differently. And we see that with this, the moves towards representation in the higher echelons in higher education, right? It's fine to say there's, you know, you can get there, but unless you see someone there, you can't imagine yourself there. You know, you can't, if you don't see Black leaders, you can't imagine being a Black leader. So these imaginative possibilities come out of encounters in our world. So what serendipity does is unexpectedly introduce new material for your imaginative possibilities. And so I think serendipity can have these kind of ethical implications as well, that we can now imagine our world differently, we can imagine ourselves differently, we can imagine our research going in a different direction, we can imagine a different outcome from the things we're doing than we thought was possible. And serendipity opens up those possibilities in a really interesting way. I recently read a really cool introductory article for a special issue in, I think, development psychology, where they were talking about how people's biases are most frequently torn down, like racism or assumptions about identities or, you know, who's going to act in what way are torn down by serendipitous moment. And so they have an encounter with the right person at the right time who changes their perspective on things and allows them to see the same things they've been looking at, but in a different way. And I think those expectations are the key. And I think when we talk about these big serendipity stories like Fleming and penicillin, I mean, penicillin opened up so many imaginative possibilities. We're looking at the effects of those new imaginative possibilities right now while we experience corona, where we don't think that people going into their garden and getting pricked by a thorn are going to die anymore, right? We really think that we are protected at a level that we didn't used to feel protected. And this has been 100 years? This imaginative assumption about how we can go out and live our daily lives is fairly recent and yet has become such a part of our lives that when it breaks down and we have to socially distance and think about each other as potential germ carriers, it really switches our way of imagining our world. And sometimes it can go the other way too, right? Sometimes it can shift in ways that constrain, but we don't know the effects on our children. Maybe they'll have a totally different view of the world. I don't know if I'm making much sense.
No, absolutely. But a lot of questions pop up in my head. So I may have this puzzled look on my face. Could working through an act of imagination, a tool for making serendipitous moments conscious? That was my one question. And then the second question was, because you mentioned when we haven't encountered certain situations in our real world, we can't imagine them. Then there is film and literature and everything that helps us imagining things. What's the role of science fiction, for example, in serendipitous processes?
Those are both very good questions. I hope you wrote
Thank
them down.
Thank you. Because I don't know. I have. Let's start with the first one because there are two questions, of course.
So about making serendipity conscious.
Yes.
This is such an interesting question because serendipity is tricky because we recognize it retrospectively. So we don't always notice it. Sometimes we do. Sometimes we're like, oh, wow, I can't believe this is happening. This is so cool and serendipitous, right? I can't believe that I'm in this restaurant and someone I know that I was just thinking about calling this week happens to be here. You know, great. Those are instantaneous kind of serendipitous moments. I mean, they're often quite personal. And on the science level, we go back, right? And we say, oh, that was a serendipitous moment because of the outcome that it produced. And two things can happen. First, we have the problem of rational reconstruction, prominent in science, where when we write an article about our discovery process, we neaten it up and make it sound all very logical and show how the connections are there, even though we might not have made them at the time. Although, interestingly, there's more and more serendipity playing a role in those scientific articles, which I really like. So that's becoming part of our understanding of the scientific process. But what moment it was that it happened, we only kind of know when we go back, right? Mm-hmm. And then between that moment that has a success and another moment that ends up in failure, there's no actual difference in that moment, right? So this question of when does it become conscious is such an interesting question because that's part of the problem with understanding serendipity and separating it out from the rhetoric. So I think that imagination might be the way in which we experience that shift in expectations in the moment. So
that's super interesting.
Let's take the example of the gentleman who invented Velcro, as often told, right? A scientist walking and taking a walk to think about a problem, ends up with a burr on his pants, and then thinks, that's a really strong fastener. I wonder what could be used for. And then does some research and ends up developing Velcro as a type of fastener, right? This is a moment of serendipity insofar as it's the right place at the right time and the right person and the right kind of, you know, but it's not like he was thinking about fasteners beforehand. I mean, who knows? Maybe he'd had a real trouble with his zipper that morning. Entirely possible. But we can't get into that psychological aspect of the moment, right? We can't say, mm-hmm. What were they thinking about at that moment? What we do know is that it started off a chain of imagining what could be possible. What does this moment make possible? Mm-hmm. That's not always conscious, though. I mean, sometimes we go on for our lives, right? And 20 years later, we go, you know, if I hadn't met that person, or if I hadn't gone to that class, or if I hadn't gotten sick on that day and missed that meeting, I would never be where I am today. And there's no consciousness in that moment or even in the process beyond until we look back and see the impact that moment actually had on what came later. So the imaginative possibilities aren't a necessary feature, I think, of serendipity. But when it does lead, especially in an individual's narrative, I think it plays a key role. So when we're talking about a person who experienced a moment and then that person went later on to make a discovery, I think their imagination is the way we can capture what's happening in that mental process, right? How are they going from the unexpected to a concrete thing? They're imagining what could this moment mean and what could be its value, and then exploring.
Yes.
Another way of thinking about this, though, is abduction, right? This ampliative hypothesis formation, which really is an act of imagining.
Could you explain abduction to?
So that comes from Charles Sanders Peirce, and who's also one of the early theorists of chance discoveries. He talks about abduction being a form of reasoning. So you've got deduction, which is kind of your mathematical reasoning, where all the answers are contained in the question and answer. And then you've got inductive reasoning, where you're looking at things that happened in the past and making predictions based on that, but there's no actual, it's, you know, it could be different. So we're taking a bit of a risk. And then there's abduction, which is that how do we get to hypotheses in the first place? And that's when we look at something that's happened, and Peirce points out that it's something that's unexpected in this case. Then you have to think about, how do I explain this? Mm-mm. What does this mean? What is this? In science, sometimes that's the question, right? What is this? So then you start to create hypotheses about what it might be. And as soon as you're in the realm of what something might be, that's imagination, right? Now you're imagining possible outcomes, possible ends, possible explanations, and discarding the ones that don't make sense, honing in on the ones that might, and then you explore those. So yeah, some people might say it's not imagination, it's abduction. And other people might say abduction is imagination.
Okay, yes. Also a question that was, we need examples to start to be able to imagine new situations.
Thank you. Yeah.
Literature, films, maybe even advertising or things we see on series on Netflix helps us imagining. How is this related with serendipity, in your opinion?
I think it highlights the importance of the encounter, right? So Rosanda Erdeles calls people who experience serendipity a lot in information gathering as a super encounterers, which is one of my favorite terms. they encounter a lot, right? And there's more to it as well. They have to be able to follow up on it. But also there's this idea that the encounter is more than just passing by or making, you know, a crossing path. It's not just that you pass each other in the hallway, you have an encounter. An encounter is something that makes a difference, right? It's something that you note.
Yes, it implies consciousness about it, right?
It does. It does. It implies two things coming together in a way that has impact somehow. And so that's another reason why I really like the way she uses that word. And so I think that's what's emphasized in serendipity as being different from our kind of passive absorption of things like cultural norms and expectations about what's possible. So say we do science all of our lives, we're taught that there's certain theories and there's a scientific method and there's progress and it's a very linear way of understanding how we learn and then develop theory and then apply it. And then you go into practice, into graduate school, and you have an encounter with how science is really done. And you're like, oh my God. And it shifts your expectations of what you should be doing now, right? And how you should be working in this environment. So I think that we need encounters to understand the importance of things like imagination to our thinking, because I think we need to experience those unexpected and kind of sometimes very profound shifts in what we imagined was happening. This is why I think as a culture we find serendipity so entrancing, because it captures that nature of the encounter. And we might have them in small ways in our lives. We might have them in ways that don't lead to discoveries. So there's kinds of encounters like this that are not necessarily serendipities, but serendipity is one kind of this kind of encounter where it really shifts your expectations, opens up new ways of imagining things. And also opens up ways of imagining yourself and how you play a role and what you can do.
In one of our podcasts, Professor Vincent Icke spoke about the importance of attentiveness. when being involved in science. And on your blog, I read that serendipity in a way is dependent on this kind of attentiveness. Could you elaborate?
Attention is one of the tricky parts of serendipity too, in the sense that you can't pay attention to everything, and we don't. Right. Our perceptual systems gear us towards paying attention to certain kinds of things. We train ourselves to pay attention to certain kinds of things. I can scan a philosophy text and find the thesis statement, you know, quite easily, because I know where to look and I know what kinds of things to attend to. What are the words they're going to use around that? Are they going to say, we will argue? You know, you attend the features of a thesis statement and I can find one in a few seconds, right? Hopefully. If I can't, then we have a problem. Then we have to write a stronger thesis statement.
But, you're trained to find these kind of, yes.
Exactly. And yes. So, and I also attend to arguments, but as you attend to things more, you learn how to attend to them. And then what's super cool, and what I think super encounterers and other people who experience a lot of serendipity, is you learn to attend to them without them being your focus. So ideally, you can attend to potentially valuable things happening in your periphery while you're also attending to what you're doing. So it has to be a balance between paying attention to possibilities happening around you that might be outside of your focused attention, which is getting the thing done that you're trying to get done. And I do think scientists do this. I don't think we emphasize enough how much that peripheral attention plays a role in shaping the actual science being done. And recognizing it favorably will push us towards doing this more often.
Mm-hmm. So you can practice it.
Yeah, this is something that I think Merton actually points this out, that one of the ways to encourage serendipity is just to recognize it more often, because then what happens is that it becomes part of normal practice. The unexpected happens all the time. When it does happen, people then are more willing to talk about it. They treat it as a potential value thing. They, you know, you talk about organizations that do this intentionally. I think it was Raghu Garud who pointed out that 3ME, in the famous post-it note example in serendipity, where someone's working on some glue and they're trying to create a, you know, a super strong glue, and they end up creating this super weak glue, and then they don't know what to do with this. And then it kind of gets brought up at different meetings and discussed of what can we do with it. Nobody knows. And some time passes between this observation and then someone else going, I really need something just to stick this paper up on the board for a minute. And somebody else goes, I've got a really weak glue, you know, and so that, and then that connection with the purpose comes about. But that organizational culture created that opportunity by keeping that idea alive on purpose. So they didn't discard the idea. They didn't say, okay, we'll just put this over there. And then it left it only to one person who knew about it to be there at the right time. Now, the organization kind of knew about this thing that they didn't know what to do with. And so when an opportunity to use it came up, then they were able to recognize it as an organization, right? And then able to maximize it as an organization, because that's the kind of invention they were looking for. So a lot of organizational theorists who work on serendipity talked about that. I really like Miguel Pena de Cunha's term, generative doubt, as an organizational stance, where you continuously think, well, maybe we could do this differently. Mm. And re-examine your expectations about how things should happen, right?
And in my belief, I think that imagination is a way to imagine things going differently, taking a different perspective on working through this imaginative act. Then my question would be, could imagination function as a catalyst for serendipity?
I don't know. This is because serendipity is what it is because of that, because it is unexpected. Mm. So once you imagine a possibility, then it's no longer unexpected, right? This is a great discussion though, because it is a problem in serendipity research too. So one of the things that's happening is there's a move amongst kind of myself and a few other theorists where we're working on what is the role of inaction in this? Do you have to interact with the world in order for serendipity to happen? You know, and Merton's serendipity pattern starts with this imposition of the world. And often serendipity is kind of thought of as evidence for realism in a certain sense, that we can still be surprised by the world. And if we can be surprised by the world, it can't be fully constructed by our social imaginations, right?
Oh, so that's nice. Yes.
But then if we can be surprised by our own brains, do we have that realism connection anymore? And this is one question I have where I'm struggling with whether we can be surprised by our own brains. And a lot of people do emphasize that sagacity is about what Alfred Kussler called bisociation, which is this unexpected connection between two ideas and finding out that they're related. So if you think about it, you've got these two ideas somewhere separated in your head, and then they come across each other. And then if we go further, so next week, the Society is having a symposium on serendipity and big data. And those questions interest me because of this idea that there might be undiscovered knowledge out there. So we know it. There's two articles written out there that have the evidence for a theory. If you just brought them together and the right person just happens to read them at the same time, then they'll make that theory happen. But the knowledge is out there. The evidence is already known. We just have to discover that. And so then we think, well, all we need is a supercomputer to start generating these discoveries, right? But then is it just about the connection? It's not just about the connection. It's about the value of the connection and the worth of following it up. It's not just in the head. It's also whether it's going to play out in the world. But that moment of surprise, can that happen? And it's not like I've never been surprised by an idea, right? That's what philosophy is about. Mm-hmm. You know, that's how we get sucked into philosophy as young students. We're sitting there, we're reading and we're thinking and we're like, oh my God, what an idea.
Yes.
You know, and you get so excited about having these exciting, these weird ideas that just make your brain think about things in different ways. And yet you're not just getting them from the book. It's the book is helping you remake connections.
Yes.
Between things that you already had in your brain.
And you can feel it, right?
Yeah. It's really exciting. Mm-hmm. And it is exciting things can happen inside your brain. So, but I'm struggling a bit, right, with what that means and how, whether that's driven by imagination. I don't know. I haven't really thought about this question. It is a good question.
Maybe a last question, but could you call them constrained inventions then?
I don't know, because I think that the moment of surprise at connection within your own head between two ideas, I think is the same shift in expectations, because what it does is reconfigure how you put all your thoughts together, right? So it changes your perception, not on the world, but on what you know. And then it's the working out of what that change means that develops into theory. I don't think it's that moment necessarily. I think the moment of surprise and the connection is one thing. And then we have to go, okay, so why is that so interesting? What is so interesting about that? Why does that make me change my mind about this? What are the implications of this new thought I have? And then that's when you start to form what it is as a discovery.
Yeah.
This is me producing new theory on the fly.
Okay. Well, just because there's so much to think about, and I really feel that there's more to this. Also, the connection between imagination, the role of imagination in serendipity, and
can I add one?
Yes, of course. Please do. Yes,
because it kind of follows up on your earlier question about science fiction, and also as a philosopher and an ethicist, I think one of the more important roles I can play in the world is to feed in good ideas into our general consciousness, the kinds of ideas we encounter, and put more good ones out there, and then more people will encounter them, and these changes happen, I think, bottom up over time. I think it has to be like a shift in consciousness.
Wow.
To make a real change in the world. And so there that's deeply personal, but something like science fiction is interesting because what it does is throw out those ideas. So even in the realm of technology, and there's a question of, would we have the cell phones we have if it weren't for Star Trek?
Yes, I know. I always use Star Trek.
Different kind of cell phone, right?
Yes.
Right, for brain implants? Would we have, you know, done something differently? And who knows? We can't tell that, right? We can't say. But I do think there's something to say for these ideas being out there and encountering them at a subconscious level, not knowing that they're there necessarily, right? Until they're connected with something else. And often serendipity is that kind of experience in the narrative where people go, oh my God, I just remembered when I did this. And then you get this, the connection isn't just between two ideas. It's between two experiences, or between two ways of thinking, or between your present moment and a past moment. And it's that difference between them that is being surprised about. So it's not that the ideas aren't out there necessarily. And I don't know that we can say whether they are or not. I don't think that's something we can trace. And in what kind of form? But I do know that the serendipity in my own life has often been from noticing things that I didn't really notice I noticed. So this is, you know, it's attentiveness without really paying attention. And I think we all have that, right?
Yes. And time is an important aspect, right? Yes.
Yes.
When the time is ready, you can tap into this cloud of ideas. Yeah.
Or the time to think.
Yes.
Or the time to wander through that or look up that reference that I can't quite remember that might be somewhere in a file in my Dropbox. I don't know. You know, like this is all, again, this is where privilege kind of comes into play. Right?
Yes.
We have to support each other in enabling those processes because not everyone has that time.
Samantha, just to finish this wonderful conversation, where to start? Do you have any suggestions for me or for our listeners to which books should we read or which series should we watch?
Oh, that's a good question.
Do you have any tips?
I haven't thought about TV in terms of serendipity. Huh. Although, I mean, you know, to mention another, I mean, it's more science fiction, right? Star Wars is really about the serendipity of R2-D2. But definitely the Merton and Barber book, Travels and Adventures of Serendipity. And then, I mean, the Serendipity Society is, it's growing so fast. I can't even keep up with the resources that are coming out. But the resources page is a great place to start. It's impressive just how much has been written. And lots of it's rigorous research, but also full of great stories and perspectives and ideas about how to think about serendipity and use it in your practice.
I will share the links of the books, the authors mentioned.
Thank you. That would be awesome. Yeah.
Yes. And your site, of course. And I want to thank you for this super inspirational talk. Thank you so much.
It's really fun talking about imagination. And I'm looking forward to see your work coming out on it as well. Obviously, I don't have a theory yet.
Wow, some work for me cut out here. Thank you.
For more information, links and show notes, visit scientificimagination.org. In the next podcast episode, I will go into conversation with Marcus D. Anderson, an innovator and thought leader working at the nexus of indigenous wisdom, modern technology, and future communities.